London says tonight that we can expect a joint declaration of solidarity of the Allies against the Axis. A pledge signed by all those on our side that none of us will make a separate peace. But in Washington, the news is not about diplomatic moves, but about war moves. Moves to strengthen our fighting front. A Senate and House committee tonight authorized the Navy to take 50,000 men from the selective service rolls. In other words, the men in Washington are thinking about a bill that will permit the Navy to get draftees as well as the Army. The measure, as it now stands, also would permit the Marines to draft men. This Navy-Marine draftee system is the latest development of a day that saw most of the restrictions on the Selective Service Act go down the Washington sink. From today on, the government can send draftees abroad, and all draftees, as well as everyone else in our armed forces, must serve for the duration and then for 6 months more. And the War Department urged legislation which will permit the registration of all men from the ages of 18 to 64 and the drafting for service of all men between the ages of 19 and 44. Meantime, the White House is acting on the labor situation. The president has ordered a meeting between 12 leaders in industry and 12 leaders of labor in Washington next Wednesday. The job of this group will be to formulate a program of increased defense production by getting rid of strikes, lockouts, or industrial disputes. President Roosevelt has called this meeting of labor and industry to obtain a no-strike agreement during the period of the war, and so that labor and industry can define appropriate practices for both labor and management and secure maximum production for war needs. The government also set up a nationwide war insurance system, insurance against property damage by enemy bombs, bullets, and shells. And it's one kind of insurance you don't have to pay for in premiums. All you have to do, if your property is damaged by enemy action, is tell the Federal Insurance Corporation about it, and they'll send over an adjuster and pay the bill. The insurance does cover damage to buildings, structures, and personal property, including goods, growing crops, and orchards. But it does not cover such items as currency, notes, documents, or objects of art, such as paintings. Meanwhile, there's a move on to coordinate all military and naval commands in the Pacific. And the Army and Navy Register, a serviceman's publication, by the way, says that it would surprise no one if Admiral William D. Leahy, the president ambassador to Vichy France, would get this job. The Navy service paper goes on to say that some coordination of our war effort in the Pacific is very probable, even if a shakeup does not take place in our Army and Navy commands. And now a few bulletins. From Cokeburg, Pennsylvania. More than 900 captive coal miners who were on strike last month have donated one day's pay for national defense. An officer of United Mine Workers Local at Cokeburg says the union will send a check to the president, quote, for use as he sees fit, to help our sailors and soldiers and to help defeat Japan, Hitler, and Mussolini. Washington. It appears that automobile owners aren't going to slip out from under that $5 annual use tax after all. A plan for collection of the tax by post office sale of stamps has been approved by a Senate House committee. Under the plan, every auto owner will be required to go to a post office before February 1st and buy a stamp costing $2.09. On July 1st, a full $5 tax will become due for the following fiscal year. All air raid posts in Birmingham, Alabama have been placed on the alert, and the head of the Jefferson County Defense Council declares flatly that the orders are based on the possibility of a raid. Birmingham is a strategic center of defense production. The head of the Defense Council at Birmingham says, our information is sufficient to cause us to prepare immediately. It is impossible, of course, for us to reveal the source of our information. The alert will be continued until further notice. And now for the sports news. There were two hockey games tonight in the National League, and the Metropolitan teams lost both of them. The New York Rangers lost to Toronto 2-1 on a fluke. Ranger Otto Heller kicked in the winning goal accidentally, that is, into his own nets. The Brooklyn Americans lost to the Montreal Canadiens 3-2 in an overtime game. In Madison Square Garden, blacked out again as it was last night for the fight, there was an intersectional basketball game. Long Island University defeated the University of Oregon 33-31 on a long goal by Hank Beenders within a 40-second period to play. And up at Syracuse, the Manhattan College Cagers lost their game 41-35. And now just a few more bulletins. Now that we've given you the sports news, here one from San Francisco. Censorship is in force on telegrams between the United States and Mexico. It was learned today when a message between San Francisco and Mexico City bureaus of the United Press was stopped by censorship because it was in Spanish. From Norfolk, Virginia, curtains and shades were drawn, street lights were out, and automobile lights were dimmed at sundown tonight as Norfolk held its first test blackout. The blackout was scheduled to continue all night. The blackout was voluntary for the approximately 230,000 people in the city who were reminded by radio stations each half hour regarding lights off. And from Bogota, Colombia, 32 members of the Colombian Army, arrested about 3 months ago when a seditious movement was reported, were ordered released today. And from that same source, more than 3,100 Axis nationals reside in Colombia, police said today, and it was announced that of the 21,599 foreign residents of the country, 1,833 are Germans, 294 Japanese, and 1,013 Italians.
Cokesburg, Pennsylvania. More than 900 captive coal miners who were on strike last month have donated 1 day's pay for national defense. An officer of the United Mine Workers Local at Cokesburg says the union will send a check to the president, quote, for use as he sees fit to help our sailors and soldiers and to help defeat Japan, Hitler, and Mussolini. Washington. A threatened strike at the Anaconda Copper Mining Company at Butte, Montana, is in the hands of the National Mediation Board. AFL workers have demanded wage increases for 175 members. Washington. Selectees may soon find themselves headed for the Navy and Marines. Authorization for the Navy to take 50,000 men from selective service roles has been approved by a Senate House committee.
More late news, New York. London reiterates tonight there is still no confirmation of Tokyo's claim that Jap troops have captured Kowloon on the mainland facing Hong Kong. The London radio, heard by the NBC listening post, adds that severe fighting still rages in the Kowloon area. Midland, Texas. Secretary of the Navy Knox arrived in Midland tonight on his way to Washington after a quick trip to Honolulu. Knox was flying in a fast Navy plane and came down for an overnight stop. However, he declined to comment on the war. Pasadena, California. Directors of the Tournament of Roses Association indicated unofficially tonight that they'd call off the Rose Bowl football game on New Year's Day in the interest of national defense. Earlier, the directors received a request by the Army that the big game between Duke and Oregon State be canceled. National defense and civilian protection were the reasons given by the Army. This report came to you from the NBC newsroom.
The governor designated law enforcement officials to place in effect emergency orders drawn up by the California State Council of Defense. In the Far East, a Manila communique reviewing the first week of war announced that four Philippines-bound Japanese troop transports were sent to the bottom and three more seriously damaged. Summing up, at the end of the first week of war in the Pacific, the American Far Eastern Command announced, "The situation both on the ground and in the air is well in hand." Marines holding Wake Island against repeated Japanese aerial assaults still had command of the tiny Pacific outpost. This is the NBC San Francisco newsroom.
There has today been a deceptive silence. In a contrast to last Sunday, as marked as the difference between an exploding powder magazine and a nap after a Christmas dinner, reports since this hour last night have today been few and brief. But there could be no greater mistake than to doze off into the conclusion that not much is really going on. This war, even in those drugged first months of 39 and 40, never has been phony, and it never will be. Because since the beginning of the week, the Japanese have not been quite so violently attacking us and have not been nearly so successful where they have, is not to say that the Japs have not been fighting hard and dangerously against our allies. Few Americans, perhaps, will lose much sleep tonight because they have heard rather vaguely that some place called Kowloon, off somewhere on the coast of China, is now under a violent Japanese attack. Other word, the Japanese troops have crossed over the border of conquered Thailand into the rain forests of the elephant land of British Burma. Sounds, too, like the report of something very dim and far away. But both of those reports are, in fact, most disturbing and have a very direct effect on us. For with every yard that the Japanese army advance in either of those areas, the final defeat of Japan by us and by our allies will become more costly, slower, and more difficult. Hong Kong, which in Chinese means fair harbor, and which most beautifully fits its name, is a small British crown colony off the southeastern coast of China. Kowloon, the less familiar, is simply Hong Kong's mainland suburb, only a quarter of a mile away across the bay. and Kowloon is much bigger and in many ways more important than is Hong Kong itself. If, as Tokyo reports, and the concern of the British seems to more or less confirm, a Japanese army is in Kowloon, but not yet in Hong Kong, it is just like saying that an enemy army is in Brooklyn, but not in New York, in Oakland, but not yet in San Francisco. Fortunately, though, the Japs have been smashing hard at their objective now for a full week, and they are not having things all their own way by any means. Behind that 376 square miles of the Chinese mainland, which the British have owned by treaty since 1898, there rise up tumbled, low ranges of bare, brown earth hills, which are in China proper. And over those hills, the Japanese army in full force and with complete military equipment came storming on last Sunday morning, the very moment that they went to war. Below them, at once within gunshot, lay the white, clean, and crowded city of Kowloon, with its 500,000 Chinese population. Behind the town, on other hilltops, though, are tough British forts and even tougher garrisons. And though news is scant, it seems that they have fought both hard and well. But the Japanese have gained ground. The necessarily untrustworthy reports out of Tokyo claim, indeed, the Jap artillery has now been advanced to where it can actually lob shells across the water at Hong Kong itself, at the island part of the city across that magically beautiful bay, where the great city climbs up in wide white steps against the steep green hillside. Maybe. But it may also be that those Japanese intruders into the second busiest customs port in all of China may very soon hastily have to turn around. Four strong forces of General Chiang Kai-shek are hot-footing it close behind them and are shoving hard. Chungking has today reported harassing Chinese forces only 8 miles away behind Kowloon, and other Chinese units is raising hob with the Japanese supply lines, which connect the Japanese attackers on Kowloon with their base at Canton, 60 miles away up the Pearl River. The purpose of the Jap effort to seize Hong Kong, exactly like the earlier enemy attacks on Guam and on the American Pacific Islands, is all too obvious. The Japanese, acutely conscious of their exposed and congested tinderbox wooden cities, strung closely together along the Japan coast, are trying desperately to protect themselves. Hong Kong is simply the nearest naval and plane base to Japan itself, which is now held by any of the Allied powers. Already, Tokyo has nervously reported that Formosa, which is Jap-owned too, and is quite close to Hong Kong, has had one air raid scare. With Hong Kong gone, Japan at once would move several hundred miles further from the threat of enemy attack, from anything but an aircraft carrier. Down in the Malay States, where the Japs are campaigning with the double purpose of trying to close the Burma Road and of trying to put Singapore out of business, and both are tough assignments, there is equally hard fighting. A major battle is reported as developing in the dense tiger jungles of North Malaya near the Thailand border. And there is an ominous report that the enemy is fighting its way south with the aid of tanks and armored cars, overland toward Singapore, some 400 miles away. In a way, that strategy is a great compliment to the immense power of Singapore. For the Japs, one notices, have not attempted a direct frontal attack on that gigantic and very watchful British island naval base. The Japanese in Malaya are trying, in fact, just what the Germans attempted in the Crimea, when they sought to take the Russian naval base of Sevastopol by attacking it by land and from the rear. And I seem to remember that that enterprise for a much better army and in wide-open, treeless country has turned out after many months of trying to have been a most gigantic flop. But any threat to Singapore is grave. If anything should happen to Singapore, the British in the Pacific would be pushed back from contact with us for at least 1,000 miles. And if Singapore should fall, the coasts of the Dutch East Indies would then be left wide open to Japanese attack. Happily, there does not seem much immediate danger of that happening. Though vigorous Jap attacks continue over several important military objectives, the situation in the Philippine area continues to remain generally excellent. The Japanese invasion parties are now ashore at only 3 places on the island of Luzon, and nowhere else. And at those 3 Luzon beachheads, it is admitted that the Japanese are hanging on, but apparently hanging on with somewhat the same white-knuckled insecurity with which a man hangs on to a precipice which he can't quite crawl over. The defenders of Wake, under the burning sun and among the startled seabirds, still make great military history. There, another hard Japanese effort from the air today to bomb the defenders out. But the Japs again went off discomfited, with two bombers less than they came with, and the Marines still hold that tiny island. The news from Russia continues to be so good, so astonishingly good, that a great many people, out of plain contrariness, simply won't believe it. One Moscow dispatch tonight describes the Soviet army as rampant, and another Soviet dispatch calls it, with great enthusiasm, rebounding. That rebounding, rampant army, the Russians insist, has now turned the Nazi withdrawal on all fronts into a plain rout. Pravda, the great communist newspaper published in Moscow, says that a whole generation of Nazis has now been destroyed on the Russian battlefields. They call the German retreat the greatest disaster ever to befall Hitler, and the blind, stumbling, backward march of the Nazi hosts is likened to that of the French Grande Armée in 1812, when that last little man who dreamt of Europe's conquest rode with his great dark cape wrapped around him and his pale face bent down, westward to his chapter's end, and to the field of Waterloo, then still 3 years away. It is a phenomenal claim that the Nazi invincibles are really linked. One must remember that the Russians, roused by local victories, are naturally overexcited, and no doubt one must make allowances. But a strange sound indeed, is heard tonight across the European continent, a sound which may, to some very slight extent, perhaps help to confirm that Russian news. It is the sound of a scared mouse growling. The Vichy government of France, under the direction and under the direct orders of Marshal Henri Pétain, has protested and condemned in severe language an action of the German government. Vichy, with unexpected courage, bitterly regrets the Nazis' latest announced intention to butcher in reprisal another 100 Paris Jews and alleged communists. That is an important matter of fact and record, is the very first protest that the Pétain government of France, completely under the German boot heel and sworn to full collaboration with Adolf Hitler, has ever dared to utter against the Nazis since that long ago armistice of Compiègne. And that sums up the most important events of the past day, as we know them here. This is John W. Vandercook in New York saying, good night, all.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.